bride's personal appearance in this dream, the marriage fantasy has even got the better of the arrest fantasy which conceals it. The fact that this bride finally displays a beard, I can explain from an inquiry. I had no chance to make an analysis. The dreamer had on the previous day crossed the street with a friend who was just as hostile to marriage as himself, and had called his friend's attention to a beautiful brunette who was coming towards them. The friend had remarked, "Yes, if only these women wouldn't get beards as they grow older, like their fathers." Of course, there is no lack of elements in this dream on which the dream disfigurement has done more thorough work. Thus the speech, "I will pay later," may have reference to the conduct of the father-in-law in the matter of dowry, which is uncertain. Obviously, all kinds of scruples are preventing the dreamer from surrendering himself with pleasure to the fantasy of marrying. One of these apprehensions, lest one's freedom be lost when one marries, has embodied itself in the transformation to a scene of arrest. Let us return to the thesis that the dream activity likes to make use of a fantasy which is finished and at hand, instead of creating one afresh from the material of the dream thoughts. We shall perhaps solve one of the most interesting riddles of the dream if we keep this fact in mind. I have on page 21 related the dream of Mori, who is struck on the back of the neck with a stick, and who awakes in the possession of a long dream, a complete romance from the time of the French Revolution. Since the dream is represented as coherent and as explicable by reference to the disturbing stimulus alone, about the occurrence of which stimulus the sleeper could suspect nothing, only one assumption seems to be left, namely, that the whole rich, elaborated dream must have been composed and must have taken place in the short space of time between the falling of the stick on Maury's cervical vertebra and the awakening induced by the blow. We should not feel justified in ascribing such rapidity to the waking mental activity, and so are inclined to credit the dream activity with a remarkable acceleration of thought as one of its characteristics. Against this inference, which rapidly becomes popular, more recent authors, Le Lorrain, Egger, and others, have made emphatic objection. They partly doubt the correctness with which the dream was reported by Maury, and partly try to show that the rapidity of our waking mental capacity is quite as great as that which we may concede without reservation to the dream activity. The discussion raises fundamental questions, the settlement of which I do not think concerns me closely. But I must admit that the argument, for instance, of Egger has not impressed me as convincing against the guillotine dream of Maury. I would suggest the following explanation of this dream. Would it be very improbable that the dream of Maury exhibits a fantasy which had been preserved in his memory in a finished state for years, and which was awakened, I should rather say alluded to, at the moment when he became aware of the disturbing stimulus? The difficulty of composing such a long story with all its details in the exceedingly short space of time which is here at the disposal of the dreamer then disappears. The story is already composed. If the stick had struck Maury's neck when he was awake, there would perhaps have been time for the thought, "Why, that's like being guillotined." But as he is struck by the stick while asleep, the dream activity quickly finds occasion in the incoming stimulus to construct a wish fulfillment, as though it thought, this is to be taken entirely figuratively, "Here is a good opportunity to realize the wish fantasy which I formed at such and such a time while I was reading." That this dream romance is just such a one as a youth would be likely to fashion under the influence of powerful impressions does not seem questionable to me. Who would not have been carried away, especially a Frenchman and a student of the history of civilization, by descriptions of the Reign of Terror, in which the aristocracy, men and women, the flower of the nation, showed that it was possible to die with a light heart, and preserved their quick wit and refinement of life until the fatal summons? How tempting to fancy oneself in the midst of all this as one of the young men who parts from his lady with a kiss of the hand to climb fearlessly upon the scaffold. Or perhaps ambition is the ruling motive of the fantasy, the ambition to put oneself in the place of one of those powerful individuals who merely, by the force of their thinking and their fiery eloquence, rule the city in which the heart of mankind is beating so convulsively, who are impelled by conviction to send thousands of human beings to their death, and who pave the way for the transformation of Europe, who, meanwhile, are not sure of their own heads, and may one day lay them under the knife of the guillotine, perhaps in the role of one of the Girondists, or of the hero, Danton. The feature, accompanied by an innumerable multitude, which is preserved in the memory, seems to show that Maury's fantasy is an ambitious one of this sort. But this fantasy, which has for a long time been ready, need not be experienced again in sleep. It suffices if it is, so to speak, touched off. What I mean is this. If a few notes are struck, and someone says, as in Don Juan, "That is from Figaro's Wedding by Mozart," memories suddenly surge up within me, none of which I can in the next moment recall to consciousness. The characteristic phrase serves as an entrance station from which a complete whole is simultaneously put in motion. It need not be different in the case of unconscious thought. The psychic station which opens the way to the whole guillotine fantasy is set in motion by the waking stimulus. This fantasy, however, is not passed in review during sleep, but only afterwards in waking memory. Upon awakening, one remembers the details of the fantasy which in the dream was regarded as a whole. There is, withal, no means of making sure that one really has remembered anything which has been dreamed. The same explanation, namely, that one is dealing with finished fantasies which have been set in motion as wholes by the waking stimulus, may be applied to still other dreams which proceed from a waking stimulus, for instance, to the battle dream of Napoleon at the explosion of the bomb. I do not mean to assert that all waking dreams admit of this explanation, or that the problem of the accelerated discharge of ideas in dreams is to be altogether solved in this manner. We must not neglect the relation of this secondary elaboration of the dream content to the other factors in the dream activity. Might the procedure be as follows? The dream-creating factors, the impulse to condense, the necessity of evading the censor, and the regard for dramatic fitness in the psychic resources of the dream, these, first of all, create a provisional dream content, and this is then subsequently modified until it satisfies the exactions of a second instance. This is hardly probable. It is necessary rather to assume that the demands of this instance are from the very beginning lodged in one of the conditions which the dream must satisfy, and that this condition, just like those of condensation, of censorship, and of dramatic fitness, simultaneously affect the whole mass of material in the dream thoughts in an inductive and selective manner. But of the four conditions necessary for the dream formation, the one last recognized is the one whose exactions appear to be least binding upon the dream. That this psychic function, which undertakes the so-called secondary elaboration of the dream content, is identical with the work